from way back. We're partly celebrating Black History Month, and I thought there would be a nice idea to bring it home and to talk about the history of the Black community in Fairbanks, but also just my continuing curiosity about the changes in Fairbanks and different people's perspective on what it's been like to live here, because I do feel we live in a special place. My guests are Jo Elizabeth Porter, Eva Williams, and Reverend Sam Banks. Welcome to Home Fires.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's start with a question that I very often start with. What brought you to Fairbanks, and when did you come? Jo, why don't we start with you?
Okay. You mean when I came to Fairbanks or when I came to Alaska?
Well, let's start with Alaska. That's all.
I came to Alaska in 1942, from Seattle, Washington.
Uh-huh. Were you born in Seattle? Did you grow up in Seattle?
No, I wasn't born in Seattle. I was born in Columbus, Ohio. My grandmother brought me to Ellingsburg, Washington. That's where I was reared at.
Uh-huh. And then how old, well, yeah, I don't really care how old you were when you came. I'm not interested in putting the pieces together that way, but you were an adult when you came.
Yes,
and you
I
came
was.
On your own.
Yes, I did.
And where did you land in Alaska when you first got here?
In Anchorage.
Uh-huh.
And I stayed there and waited table for a while. Then I went over to Kodiak, Alaska. And I cooked over there and waited table and washed dishes.
Uh-huh.
Clean house.
How long were you in Kodiak?
I was in Kodiak about 3 years.
What was it like then?
It a town of 1,000 at that time. That was in 42.
Uh-huh. What were people doing for a living then?
Oh, they had a school there and a lot of bars and few homes. It's a seaport town.
Uh-huh.
And everybody had work.
Fishing.
Fishing.
Mm-hmm. It's a good fish. 1,000 people. Does anybody know what the population of Kodiak is now?
I think it's about 15,000, maybe more than that.
Have you been back in recent years?
I've been back there a lot of times.
Has it changed a lot?
Oh, yes.
More than Fairbanks?
They even have
or?
Paved streets there.
Kodiak's gone uptown.
Yeah.
Okay, so then after Kodiak, where'd you go?
I went back to Seattle, went to beauty school, and then I came back up and stayed in Anchorage for a while, then came up to Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been here ever since.
And that was in the 40s?
No, that was in the early 50s.
Early 50s.
I came back the last time in the 50s.
Uh-huh. But before statehood?
Oh, yes. Quite a while before statehood.
Eva.
Yes.
When did you come to Alaska?
In 1944.
Uh-huh. Where did you come from? We were talking about it in the...
From San Francisco.
Oh, from San Francisco. We were talking about how you'd grown up in Chicago, yes?
Yeah, I had moved to San Francisco and... It was my vacation time, and a friend of my sister's had come out from Alaska to go to the hospital, and my sister knew him, and he came over to the shop where we had a beauty shop, and we was asking him about Alaska, and he told us all about it. So I was getting ready to go back to Chicago on a vacation. I always took 8 weeks. And my sister said, "Why don't you go to Alaska?" And I said, "No, I don't think so. My money might run out." So she said, "Well, if you want to go," she said, "if you need some money, I'll send you some money." And her and I and her husband had just bought a new home, and I bought it with them. And she said, "If you want to stay, as long as you send some money home on the bill." So I'm still here.
Did you eventually pay off that house, or did you just sell it?
Oh, we sold. We paid it off a long time ago.
How long after you first moved here did you decide that this was going to be the place you were going to settle at least for a while?
Well, I stayed in Anchorage. When I first came to Anchorage, There wasn't over 25 blacks in Anchorage.
That was a real minority.
Yeah, and then I went outside in 46. Then I come back up, and when I came back up, then I moved to Fairbanks, and it was only about 12 or 13 blacks in Fairbanks.
Is that right? And is that how many blacks were here?
13.
13.
Oh, my.
What was the population of Fairbanks then? Do you know?
No, I don't know.
If someone in our listening audience, our number is 474-5044. If someone in our listening audience knows what the population was at the end of the 40s, early 50s, that would be nice information so we could see. I mean, 13 out of 100 is a lot, but I know there were more people than that. But I really don't know whether it was 10,000 residents at that time or 15, whatever. Anyway, our number is 474-5044. 13 blacks, and were you already here? No, Eva came first before Joe.
What?
Oh, Joe came first.
So there was 12 before she arrived.
Right, and then 13. And Reverend Banks, you said before the show that you had a ministry here in the 50s, 57 and 58?
56 and 57. Oh. I pastored the St. John's Baptist Church at 17th and Turner.
Mm-hmm. And where did you come from?
Came from California, San Rafael.
Uh-huh. A pretty fancy neighborhood, San Rafael.
It's Northern California.
Uh-huh. And then you went back to California?
Yes, I went back to California and pastored and built what is called the Village Baptist Church. I was gone from Alaska for 16 years. Now I've been back for 11, so...
I was kidding you before. I said too much sunshine and soft living. You need to suffer a little bit.
Yes.
But now you're here for good, right?
Here for good.
Until you retire at any rate, which is a long way away. Well, you've all seen a lot of changes. Could you describe your impressions of Fairbanks when you first came here, Joe?
Yes, I thought it was, well, the town that I was raised in, Fairbanks looked quite a bit like it. Only we did have a few more paved streets in Ellensburg, Washington than they had up here. And it was a small town from Fifth Avenue to First Avenue down to Noble Street was the town.
That's really a fairly central, just real small downtown area. Where did you live when you first moved here?
I lived on Fifth Street with a lady that rented me a room. It was hard for me to get a place to stay because I was alone. My husband didn't come up with me. And then I moved to the Savoy Hotel.
Hmm. Where was the Savoy?
Miss McGowan got me a room there. Eva McGowan.
Very famous female Fairbanks resident.
So I stayed there, but it was pretty hard for me to get a place to stay. And then I stayed down on 3rd Street with Zora Banks. Well, she was living with her auntie. And then I had work all over town, cleaning house. And I got the job at the, well, it's a post office now, federal building it was then,
uh-huh.
And post office. And that's where I retired from, 24 and a half years. I got the job in 50 and...
stayed there until this...
75.
No, 75. So you were right downtown seeing all the changes occur.
Oh, yes.
Where was that building, the federal building?
Right where it is now. They call it the Courthouse Square now.
Right, okay. Different purpose because the post office has moved and the...
Yeah.
But the building's still there. Where did you live when you first came to Fairbanks, Eva?
Oh, I lived at Wendell and Hall, mm-hmm. right on the corner. And I bought a home there. And I had run a rooming house. I didn't do hair work for 10 years. I was tired of it. So I ran the rooming house. And then I opened the first barbecue in this town. And... I lived right on the corner of Hall and Wendell, the bridge wasn't even in there.
I was gonna say, was Wendell Street Bridge there? No.
No, they put the bridge there in 1953. And when they were putting a bridge in, I was putting a restaurant in on the other side because it was a commercial district and you could have a business there. So I put a restaurant in beside the building, and I had got married then, and my husband was a cook, so we ran Eva's Inn, and we served all types of barbecue and Oriental food.
Uh-huh.
And then after they put the bridge in, it was so dusty down there. And my house was so dusty. And when I got ready to open the door for the restaurant, I'd call the city and tell them, bring the water truck down. And they would come down and water right in front of that and leave.
Well, they were very accommodating anyway.
Oh, yeah,
in those
they were
days.
Nice.
Was Fairbanks excited when they got their first barbecue? Did you have people storming the doors right away?
Oh, yeah, well, another girl and I, we wanted something to do, and so we opened this barbecue, and it was where Montgomery Ward's store is there, the building. We opened it in 49. The building burnt in 53. And... the owner that I rented from, it was a new building he had put in there. He let us cut the back out, and we put a barbecue pit in there, and the barbecue was going around, and we opened at 5 o'clock in the evening till 5 in the morning. And I think the first month we sold 1,600 pounds of spare ribs. And that didn't include the ham, the beef, the prime rib. And you could only buy prime rib in Fairbanks at two restaurants on Sunday only.
Uh-huh.
So we put it in every day. There was no fresh chickens here, so we would ship in fresh chickens and serve them halves Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and orders to go. And the biggest order I ever sold was 50 dinners.
50 dinners at one time?
One time.
Do you remember what the prices were when you opened?
Yeah, I think prime rib was around $3.50, and barbecue was, spare ribs was $2.50, something like that. And we had sandwiches and then ham dinners, pork dinners, and all that, you know.
Did you have a hard time getting supplies? Was that a problem at that time, or was transportation good?
No, it was better then when we went in 49, but usually when they used to have to fly produce up, it was high, but if you wanted it, you bought it.
Well, that's still the way here.
Yeah.
But the military presence was fairly significant at that time, is that?
Yeah, the military, when the military was led then, and there was no houses, and I think around between 46 and 48, they started building out there. And then they brought more people in. And then they brought in a lot of black people for engineers and workmen when they were building.
Mm-hmm. So actually, although there were very few blacks here when both of you arrived, you saw the black population increase rather rapidly after your arrival?
Mm-hmm. Well, out at the Laird Field, there was a lot. And in the spring of the year, there was a lot. People that came up here in the spring of the year to work on the roads and different projects.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, a lot of blacks stayed after they were here in the military. I get that impression still. Do all of you agree, or that a lot of the black community has first come up because of their military?
Well, a lot of them stayed up here.
Uh-huh. What do you think the attraction is?
Well, it was a growing town, and I guess, well, the reason that I stayed up here, because the climate was so much like the climate where I was raised at in Ellensburg, Washington.
I had no idea it was so cold there.
Oh, yes, but we always, the snow was always gone along, well, Easter time. Because my grandmother would always buy me two pair of shoes, a pair of slippers and a pair of shoes, if it would either snow or rain on Easter Sunday. So whichever one, we wore the shoes to go
with it. Take care of the weather no matter
That's
what.
That's right.
It was always miserable. I remember when I was a kid, it wasn't so long ago, you get all dressed up on Easter Sunday, and if the weather was terrible, everyone was just miserable because your coat was never a real winter coat. It was always some little frilly thing. Reverend Banks, you came up in for good 10 years ago. Had you come in the meantime during your 16 years in California? Were you surprised at the changes?
Well, I came, it was yet in the period of statehood, before statehood, and the streets, I think, had extended to some degree from what my neighbors here had indicated. It had extended to airport, to Gaffney. I saw Gaffney's curbs and gutters put in, so at least the town had reached that far. Of course, when I had gone back to California in 57, I left a number of people who were still military orientated, but there was also a number of people who were working on the Dew Line, the earlier warning system. So that brought a number of the people who made up the constituency of our church, military and the civilian populace. It had begun to grow.
What was the size of your congregation in 56, 57?
56, 57, I'd say we'd have about 70, 60 to 70, and they were all military.
Was that the only black church in Fairbanks at the time?
No, there were two others.
Were you parishioners of his, or is that a improper question?
No, I visit sometime, you know.
I visit all the churches, from Catholic on down.
How many predominantly black churches are there now?
There are five.
Five.
Yes.
With very active congregations.
Very active. Very wonderful people.
I've heard some of the music. It's wonderful. What would you describe Fairbanks physically looking in 56, 50, 57? That was just before statehood.
Before statehood, it was beginning again to grow because of the necessity of military. And a lot of the people who had worked in the military and who were on the civilian Dew Line had begun to consider permanent residency. So that now entails me pastoring for the second time some of the people that I had pastored in 56 at St. John's Baptist Church. So the population, I think, has continued to grow primarily with the military emphasis. And of course, I came back in 73 to the Corinthian Baptist Church, growth had begun to develop because of the oil industry. And it was slow at first. The growth at our church was rather slow. But with more and more military people retiring and returning, and more of the people who worked in civilian life, instead of going out during the winter, they remained. The population has begun to stabilize and continues to grow until this day.
Do you feel that the black population in Fairbanks has had no more or less employment problems than the white, or is it different? Is the black population have a higher unemployment rate here, as is true in so much of the lower 48, or not?
I think the high unemployment rate is still very, very noticeable here. And of course, it's even more noticeable in the lower 48. I guess we have more people who are exposed to larger communities. But again, I think one of the facets that's going to happen is that we're going to have more black entrepreneurship, that is, people who have small businesses such as the kind Eva has spoken of. And that is going to have to prevail so that those persons who are not working for the unions are not working for civilian civil service or for the civilian contractors. They're going to have to develop a bit more with the help of the larger community to be their own entities.
Again, audience, our number is 474-5044. If you have any memories to share with us or questions to ask my guests, I welcome your participation. 474-5044. So, Eva, when your restaurant burned down in 53, did you just decide you'd had enough of restauranting and...
No, it burned in 49, the first one. Then I opened the other one by the rooming house. I had a large lot there, and George Nervous used to own the Ford Company at 2nd and Noble Street. I went by there one day, and he had taken his office building up and had it on Jack's. And I asked his office girl, what is he going to do with that building? She said, he's going to move it out on 23rd and Cushman. I said, oh, I want to buy it. So she said, if he sell it to anybody, he'll sell it to you. So I went and I asked him, I wanted to buy it. And he said, how much you give me for it? I said, well, now I'm not going to argue with you about the price. You tell me what you want for it. And if I want it, I'll say yes, you know. So he told me, and then the logs were rotten under the foundation, and I said, and put some new logs on it. And since you got it jacked up, just move it down on Wendell Street, and you pay for it. So he didn't put the logs on it, but he brought the logs with it.
Uh-huh.
So later I had it put on concrete, a basement dug, put on concrete, put a furnace in, and fixed the building up, and I had a barbecue down there. And I think in 67, the two buildings, I had them burnt down because the guys all that hung around the street and drank, they'd go in there and sleep in there, so I had them burnt down. I'd sold a lot in 75.
But you'd moved your business out before the fire?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How long... Okay, I guess I was a bit confused on that point. How long did you have the barbecue? When did you go out of the barbecue business?
Well, I opened a school in 59. And then See, during the 10 years, I told you I didn't do beauty work. I was in restaurant business.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first came up here, as I had a beauty license, operator's license for Illinois, California, and a teacher's license for California. But nobody would hire me. So
Alaska.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then I did little work, you know, on the side, but then I had to supply a job for myself, you know. So I always made jobs for myself, and since then I don't want to work for nobody.
Well, I've had a business of my own briefly, and it is very self-satisfying, all the pressures on you, of course, and the
yeah.
bills are all yours, but also anything you do for yourself, and there's...
Yeah.
Some real benefit to that. How long did you practice in a beauty shop in San Francisco? You said you had one with your sister?
Mm-hmm. I went to San Francisco in 1940 after my mother died in Chicago, and my sister kept after me to come to San Francisco. So my sister was a beauty operator, too. And when you first go to California with a license from another state, you have to take examination because they have so many operators there, they won't let you in unless you take an examination. So I went to a school and took a 2 month brush-up because I hadn't had the theory in 5 years, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I passed after the 2 month brush-up, you know. Then the supervisor asked me if I would take a teacher's course, and I asked her how much it was, and she told me, and I said, well, I'm staying with my sister and her husband, so I'll ask her. So when I asked my sister, and she said, well, if you want to take it, I'll pay for it, and I really didn't want to take it. So my sister said, well, if you take it, at least you won't have to ask anybody anything. You'll know all about it. So, well, I went back the next day and I told a story. The supervisor said, what did your sister say? I said, she said she didn't have no money. So she said, and I said, I wouldn't make a teacher anyway. You know, she said, you're just one of those natural born teachers, and I tell you what I'll do. If you take it and go 600 hours, I'll give it to you. So that's how I got
it. I'm not real knowledgeable about this, but I've done some reading in women's history, and I know that Black Beauty products were one of the first opportunities for Black women to really go into business for themselves, and there were some fairly famous ones that developed an entire line of products.
Adam C.J. Walker.
Uh-huh.
And the one that had Poro and Apex, I don't remember, it's been so long who owned them, but I know Madam C.J. Walker was one of the first ones.
She was quite a special woman. Do you know much about her?
Well, she had a school in Chicago, but I didn't go to it because I went over there and I knew how to do the black work already by just knowing, you know. So then I went to Mola's, one of the first schools that was established at downtown. So that way, when I came out, I could do both of them.
There were different kinds of approaches to...
Yeah, it's a different way and you do your hair.
Mm-hmm. What was the difference?
Well, usually the black hair, you had to press it before the relaxers come out.
Uh-huh.
See, well, my sister would go to the beauty shop and come back and say, look at my hair, will you do it? So I didn't see any need of me to go there when I just went and learned the other work. So that way I was training both of them. I trained myself in the other one. And then after I finished all during the time I was going to school, I had a roommate was going to beauty school, and she had finished ahead of me, and she was working in a beauty shop, so I'd go by there every evening, and I would watch them and so forth and so on, and then they'd ask me, what'd you learn in school today? And I said, oh, I learned such and such a thing, you know. Well, how do you do that? So I'd show them. Then another day, what did you learn in school today? Oh, and then I'd tell them something else. I said, I learned how to do a crokinole marcel. That was a hot work with an iron. So then I showed them. So I was helping them too, you know. And then...
Excuse me, I hate to interrupt you, but what is that wonderful thing that you just said?
Crokinole marcel?
Yes.
It's a curl that you do with an iron with a figure eight. And then after you get through doing it, you can brush the hair out and relax it. And anywhere you want to put a wave, you can put a wave. And anywhere you want to put a curl, you can put a curl.
You have really strong hair to be able to do that much to it. Yes?
You just have to be careful about the heat and the texture of the hair, how much heat you use.
Uh-huh. Really interesting. So actually, it wasn't that there was a real argument between the two methods. It was just that they were different, and they were different approaches to beauty.
Like, yeah, and I knew the first one, so I learned the other one.
Mm-hmm. Madam Walker is someone who had a whole methodology of Black Beauty and developed a whole line of products, but she was a real philanthropist, too. My understanding is she endowed some Black colleges. Is that, do you know more or less about it than? And I know her daughter was also very ambitious and very successful following her. Okay, so you went to San Francisco and you had a beauty shop with your sister. You owned the beauty shop, the two
yes.
of you?
Yes, mm-hmm. We owned it. But my sister did come to Chicago to take beauty work. And she had never did beauty work before. So I said she was going to work in a Black shop. I made her go to a Black school.
Mm-hmm. Was it a good way to make money at that time? Was it fairly lucrative?
Yeah, well, it was better than, I don't know, going out working. I know doing school vacation when I was 14 years old in Chicago, I got a working certificate and I got a job in a pastry shop, the Morrison Hotel, and worked doing school vacation, $50 a month. And you thought that was a lot of money then, you know,
mm-hmm.
$12.50 a week.
Yeah, Joe's nodding her head. Do you think that sounds like fairly good wages at that time?
Yes, I do. I think I knew Eva before she knew me. I had been to the beauty shop in San Francisco because my sister was living in San Francisco. And when I came up here and found her up here, I knew that she was a beautician and I was a second colored beautician up here.
That's amazing. Your sister had lived in San Francisco and you had gone down?
I had gone down.
To visit her?
I went to visit my sister and I went to Eva and her sister's beauty parlor.
And so you remember them, but you didn't remember her? No, of course you have lots of customers. Right. And what was your sister doing in San Francisco?
Oh, she was living there then.
She was?
Yeah. And I went to school in Seattle, but I went to a school that you learn everything, to do all kinds of hair, and manicure, pedicure, massages.
So not just,
not just colored hair, I could do it all.
Uh-huh. And then when you came up here, you said your first job in Kodiak was in a restaurant, so you didn't...
Well, I...
You couldn't find a job.
I had plenty of hair work to do, but they didn't have shops then.
Uh-huh.
You did it right in the home.
And you liked the other work that you eventually got into?
Oh, yeah. Well... I couldn't afford to get a shop at that time, so I just worked for different people, Lawyer Taylor, Nordessa Nordale, and a whole lot of people here in town. And my days off from work after I got with the post office, I would do hair work.
I remember it was actually, even in the 50s, there were some women in the town I grew up in, Champaign, Illinois, that went to people's houses to do their hair.
Well, that's the way I did.
And you just reminded me of that. Mm-hmm. People who liked to have their hair done at their own house, and they sort of freelanced.
Well, they didn't have too many beauty shops here then. In fact, you didn't have to have a beauty shop here. You could do it in the home.
And licensing was not so strict then?
It wasn't licensed.
Especially if you did it at
home. I got my diploma out of Seattle, Washington. I never did have one for up here.
That sounds like could be a very pleasant time talking and doing here in the kitchen. That's what Tammy Wynette says she loves to do best in the world is to get together with her family and they all do each other's hair. They were all beauticians. I'm just hopeless. Not a skill that I have.
Well, I got my first license when I came up in 44.
And there was licensing through the state at that time?
Mm-hmm.
You had to take a test, just a written test, or also a practical?
No, I had had it long enough. I just got the license.
Mm-hmm.
And when I really first come up here, my aim was to open a school then. And when I wrote Juno about it, they didn't have any laws governing schools. Mm-hmm. And then a lady came, later years, came to Anchorage, and she opened a school and got a lawyer and made them make some laws. So she opened the first school, and I opened the second one.
What was her name?
I'm trying to think what her name is.
Just curiosity.
I can't think what her name is right now.
And she had a school in Anchorage.
Mm-hmm. First one, it was on C Street across from where the baseball park is right now. Agnes Burns.
Agnes Burns.
Yeah.
The first beauty school operator in in Alaska.
And then I gave Fairbanks the first one.
How many students did you have when you first opened?
When I first opened, I had 5, and I didn't take a customer for 30 days, training them. And then from then on, we was going.
Who did you work on when you were training? Each other, or?
They worked on each other and had their friends come in, and in the afternoon when they go home, they'd give their husband a facial and a manicure. And then when they got real busy, then the husbands said, don't get no more facials, no more manicures.
Right, like.
And I also had a partner when I first opened, and she died in 68. And she had a beauty shop on 2nd Avenue called the Cut and Curl. And she died in 68, and then afterwards I bought the estate out. So I haven't had a partner since, I didn't want any.
Oh, that's beauty shops. Are we boring you, Reverend Banks?
No, I'm taking it in.
Beauty shops, I think, in some ways, maybe less so now, but at one time there was sort of the female equivalent of the pool hall or the barber shop where you could go and get the news. I was in New Orleans for a few months a couple years ago, and there was a corner barber shop. You know, it was a very small residential neighborhood with all houses, and I could see the same 6 guys in there every weekend, older men, chatting and talking and waiting their turn and smoking cigars, actually. So you got all the news of Fairbanks in your school or in your shop, yes?
Not necessary.
No?
I always told them, you never talk about anybody, you never gossip, you never talk politics or things like that to the customer, you know, because they have their own way and you might insult them, you know, so it's better to be a good listener.
According
at
to
all
the
time.
Well, that's true. I agree. It's according to the fan magazines, so all those Hollywood stars use their hairdressers as some kind of psychiatrist. They tell them all the nitty-gritty. You didn't find that so much in...
No, I didn't, because I know sometime that I'd be working on a customer and she'd be talking, and sometime I'd say yes when I was supposed to say no.
That's right. It's hard to know what kind of answer they want.
Yeah.
The other thing I know about you is that you were a dancer in a dance troupe.
Yeah, well, that was in early years when I was 18. When I first went to San Francisco, you see, when I went back in 40, that was the second time I went to San Francisco. So I had been to San Francisco in 1928 to visit my sister. And that's when there was a fella living where my sister, she was renting a room from a lady, and I stayed with her. And there was another fella lived there that was playing over the orphan circuit with another fella, you know. So he was getting a show together to go to the Orients in the Far East. They had never seen a black show in the Orients in the Far East. And so I said, gee, I wished I could go. He said, can you dance? I said, I can do anything I see anybody else do, you know. So he said, well, I'll tell you, I'll let you rehearse with the show. The fella that was sponsoring the show was from Hawaii, and he would take dramatic shows to the Orient and Far East, and he would bring Burmese shows to the coast. And they wanted this fellow to get the show together for him. So he says, well, I'll tell you one thing. He may not take you because you're on account of your complexion. I said, oh, I can remedy that. I can use Indian makeup. And I did every night.
So we're on radio. They wanted you to be darker?
Yes.
Is that because, after all, this was the first black dance troupe that was going to the Orient?
Yeah, so when he came, we got this. He told me I could rehearse with the show, and if he takes you, it's okay with me. And when he came, he was at a hotel downtown in San Francisco, so he told all the girls and everyone that was rehearsing with the show to go down and talk to him, you know. And that's the first thing he said to me, but I out-talked him. And I said, well, I can be just as brown as they are by using Indian makeup. And I did. So every night I had to take a shower.
Where did you go in the Orient?
Our first stop was Honolulu, and we stayed there for 7 days. Then we went to Yokohama, and we stayed on the boat while they were unloading and loading. And while they were unloading and loading, we went over to Tokyo, played in the Grand Imperial Hotel over in Tokyo for 2 nights. Then we played Yokohama 1 night, so we was there 3 days. Then we went to Kobe, they unloaded. We played like the Elks Club of Men's, lodge that they had to show there. And then we went to unloaded in Nagasaki, and we played there a night. And then 14 days in a typhoon to Shanghai.
Goodness.
And we stayed in Shanghai 7 days, and we had 7 different shows. If we stayed in a town 7 days, we played 7 different shows.
Did people come night after night?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you had singers and dancers, too, and some skits, or?
Yeah, mm-hmm. We had singers, dancers, comedians. We even had a minstrel show, and they were all different, you know.
It must have been, was it a wonderful experience for you, or an interesting one?
It was very interesting, and we got paid for working days only, and the days that we wasn't working, we got our expenses paid and food paid and travel paid, you know. So it was just like a vacation, you know.
Uh-huh.
And we had an advance manager and a manager that the manager traveled with us. The advance manager traveled ahead of us, booked the theaters and the hotels. So when we got to a town, the manager would say, go to such and such a hotel. Your room's all picked out for you and so forth.
Amazing. You buy lots of souvenirs? Must have been.
No, not too many. Oh, we got paid in the money in the country we worked in.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and the next thing, we went to the American Express and got rid of it.
Didn't quite trust it.
Collected a lot of gold coins.
Because they have I imagine the silks were very beautiful and probably more reasonable than they are now.
Oh, yeah. Well, I brought back some things, different things for my family, like beautiful tea sets for my mother, you know, with dragons on them, and my sister, like lingerie and different things, Spanish shawls and stuff like that.
Very interesting. You, any of the rest of you have been abroad? I don't want to give only Eva's travels a fair shake. That must have been fascinating to be there at that time before the war.
Yeah, and then after we left Japan, we went to China, and we went to Shanghai, Hong Kong, Kowloon, and we left there, and we went to Manila, and from Manila, we went to Singapore, and then Ipoh, no, Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, Ipoh, and Penang. And from Penang, we went to Rangoon, Burma. Then we went down through the straits to Java. And you couldn't go out in noonday. It was 125 and all cold showers. The manager at the hotel said, you can always tell when you girls take a bath because you're out there hollering. That water was cold.
Well, and the difference between 120 degrees of heat and a cold shower, that's a real shock to the system.
Well, it wasn't a shower. It was like a trough, a bathhouse, you know, and there's little buckets up there. So I'd always get a couple of buckets and pour over me and throw water after then, you know, that's where the hollering come in. So we went from Java to India. The first time I ever seen a sleeping bag was in India. The companies that went ahead, you know, the dramatic companies, they left the sleeping bags there. So we would have to bring sheets and pillow slips, and the trains. We started riding trains then before we were riding big boats, you know. So that's where we started riding trains in India. And the trains, like compartments, you couldn't walk through. They lock in, but the windows were let down. There was a bath and everything in there. And I remember one morning, the manager said, we rode all night long, and he said, we'll have breakfast at the next town. He wired ahead and for breakfast, and it was 18 of us. And when we got off the train, there was 18 green curry breakfasts. And when we left, there was 18 green curry breakfasts sitting on the table that he had to pay for.
He ordered ahead, but he didn't tell you. Didn't tell them what.
No, and then in Java, the first morning I came down for breakfast, there was raw bacon on the platter, and hard-boiled eggs, and assorted cold meats, and the fellas had got up early, you know, and they come down and says, I said, what's all the raw bacon for? He said, that's what you're going to eat for breakfast. I said, not me. So the boys that waited table was Javanese. They couldn't speak English, you know. So I tried to tell him that, you know, to cook the bacon, but he just humped his shoulders up, and I said, who got a match? So somebody give me a match, and I picked up the platter and put on it. I got some cooked bacon.
He got the hint then.
Then we told the manager we didn't like raw bacon, we didn't like cold meats for breakfast, and we liked the eggs either scrambled or over.
Did you get them after that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then we went in India one time in Christmas. I was in, Madras or something like that. Boy, and it was below sea level, and the water, we couldn't drink water unless it was boiled. And they'd always tell me, Eva, if you find a snake in your room, just put down a bowl of milk. I said, I won't have time.
I'll be on my way out.
Yeah.
How long was this tour? When you said tour, you really meant a tour.
Yeah, I left in August and come back March.
Were you thinner?
Huh?
Were you thinner when you got back after all that food that you didn't eat?
Oh, well, I was very thin. I was 118 pounds.
Did you do any dancing after you got back, after you moved up to Fairbanks? Or?
No.
No.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a mm-hmm. opportunity to go on a trip and...
Well, when I came back to Chicago, a dancing teacher wanted me to go over the orphan circuit with a fellow, but... And he had an act, and I decided I wouldn't, you know. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, now we're back in Fairbanks, and after that terrific tour, my goodness. All of you are very active in community groups, and I know that you're politically active. What is the black community doing in Fairbanks now that we should know about?
They're trying to remain apprised of what's happening at the school level, at the community level, particularly the south side is now anticipating a community center, which is very much needed. The fact is that we have a number of people who, just for whatever reason that they come up with, do not frequent the university campus, do not frequent the Hutchison Center, and therefore they would feel more comfortable having their own pool hall or bingo tables or what have you in their Southside community. And so the city council and the borough have both worked and extensively to make this a reality. And so the community now is trying to find the proper site that this facility can be constructed. So the Southside community, and then of course they are interested in the political arena for on the national scene with Jesse Jackson out there making his debut.
I know that he was at one point before he went to Lebanon in scheduled to come to Fairbanks.
Yes, that was the itinerary at that time, but it has been altered, and possibly now he will not because of other involvements. But he has sent a representative that was here last week, and she has left some ideas and suggestions as to how the Alaskan community might be involved.
Mm-hmm. What is your feeling about his candidacy?
Well, I think it's a great opportunity for our people to raise their sights and our young people to further their efforts in education, because it does take education for, I spoke earlier on our own entrepreneurship, that is small businesses, and you just need an education for those kinds of things. And I think that the candidacy of Jackson is going to be a great aspiration to a lot of young people who are in college and who would be interested in serving their communities. I think he's going to help in that area.
I have heard him speak, and he's an amazingly strong speaker, very moving speaker. I was very affected. He's really got excellent oratorical skills. He makes an excellent campaigner in that, and he's a really strong believer in voters' registration. Are you doing something to increase the voters' registration rolls in Fairbanks?
We're attempting to. Under the auspices of the NAACP, we are asking each of the churches to have an authorized registrar. And with the new people in military and otherwise coming to the community, we encourage them to register, because that's one way of identifying their power, their expertise as a citizen. And so we need it, whether it's for school board, whether it's for the assembly, or even on a national scale.
You have a very active chapter of NAACP here in Fairbanks?
It's alive and well, but I'd say very active. I would think that you have reference to a large group. We do not have a large group, but there is a nucleus of people who maintains the NAACP forefront, in that it is the oldest civil rights organization, and we still try to keep it open and alive.
How long has the Fairbanks chapter been in existence?
Oh, it's quite a number of years. I think Eva would perhaps speak to that. Mrs. Banks spoke, that you spoke of. I remember when I first came in 56 that Mrs. Banks was one of the active persons in the NAACP, so it's quite old.
Do you remember exactly when?
No, I don't remember just when it was. I think Zora Banks had it, and I know when they revived it, they called me and asked me if I had the charter and all that, but I think, what's the lady's name, lived on Fifth Street, had the two daughters, and I think she died. What was her name? over by the graveyard?
It's not terrible when names just skip away from you.
Coleman,
Beatrice Coleman. Yes, I told him I thought she had it, and then they revived it again.
Well, there are so many things to do in Fairbanks, it's real hard to get enough people involved in everything. We're all spread very thin. I know I have that problem, that the people who are active are doing a lot of things. And so it's hard to get a group out. None of you have spoken about the cold. Did you just adjust to the cold as if it was nothing? It's actually quite a common topic on this show. And
well, it is. It isn't too cold to me because the place where I was raised, in Helensburg, Washington, we had just as much snow as they have here, but it didn't stay as long. And we dressed about the same. Of course, they didn't have boots then too much. They had goulashes.
Uh-huh.
And they had, I went through school there. And it was a small population of colored people there. Of course, they call it black now, but we call it, in those days, it was colored.
Now things have changed and the words have changed.
Yes. And it wasn't too much difference.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it was colder when you first got here than it is now? I mean, does it seem that way to you, too?
Yes, it was. Very much colder.
The winters were more severe then?
Oh, yes.
You adjusted from the change from San Francisco, Eva?
Well, I'm sorry. I never was used to San Francisco.
All that damp.
I went out from up here when it was around 40 below, and I'd walk outside and put the garbage on without putting a coat on. And in San Francisco, I was in the house and almost froze to death because it's a damp cold, and just like Chicago, it's windy. It's when we have zero here, it's warm. Chicago zero is cold.
Mm-hmm. I actually agree. I've walked down Michigan Avenue with that wind coming off that lake and just cuts right through you.
I worked in a store on Wabash in Monroe, a dress shop, and they had a dress shop on Michigan Avenue. And I had just first come back from the Orient. So I got the job by having my passport, you know. And I was married then, and my husband was a chauffeur for rich people, you know. So they called us where he worked, and they gave me the job. So I wasn't just, that's when all the dresses had hooks and eyes on them, you know. And you'd have to button them up after the lady, zip them, mm-hmm. not zip them.
I know, fasten
them up after the ladies got through trying them on, you know. So they sent me over on Michigan Avenue one day with a package. And that wind almost picked me up, and I quit.
That was it. That's all it took. Okay, well, this is very unusual that I have guests who feel that living in Fairbanks is actually easier in terms of the weather than where they came from. That's not true for you, Reverend Banks, is it?
Well, not where I came from, being a Southerner by birth and then to California. It's quite a transition, but I happen to have lived in the winter of 56 and the winter of 57 in Fairbanks, and I would want that on no one.
So it seems
so
good.
So I've been real proud of the last 10 years that I've been back.
Well, I'm certain that the Fairbanks community is glad to have you back. I thank you very much, Joe Elizabeth Porter, Eva Williams, Reverend Banks. Our executive producer has been Carla Tonella, and I've been your host, Patty Kostelic, and I'm looking forward to talking to you next week. Keep those home fires burning. Thank you. Good night.
Okay.
We can expect increasing clouds with a chance of light snow later on tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of light snow Sunday and Sunday night. The low for tonight will be 0 to 5 below. The high for tomorrow will be 10 degrees. The low for tomorrow night, 0 to 5 below. The outlook for Monday, a little cooler with a chance of flurries. It's exactly 8 o'clock, and you're listening to Public Radio for Alaska's Interior, KUACFM in Fairbanks.
From Minnesota Public Radio. Today's broadcast of A Prairie Home Companion is a recording of a show we did about a year ago from the World Theater, back before the plaster started to fall off the ceiling. And here's the show.
Well, look who's come through that door. I think we met somewhere before. Hello, love. Oh, yeah. Hello, love. Well, where in the world you been so long? I missed you so since you've been gone. Hello, love. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to A Prairie Home Companion. Coming to you live from the World Theater in downtown St. Paul. Presented every Saturday night at this time by Minnesota Public Radio and by this public radio station. Brought to you by your friends in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, the little town that time forgot, that the decades cannot improve. With Miss Stevie Beck, the Queen of the Auto Harp, Mr. Pop Wagner with us. Mr. Greg Brown is here from Iowa City. Peter Ostrushko, the Butch Thompson Trio with Charlie DeVore and Tom Lieberman. And Mr. Ross Sutter and Mary Lofgren here to help us celebrate Robert Burns' birthday a few days late. Brought to you by Powder Milk Business in a big blue box. Oh, yes. Oh, they're tasty and expeditious. Hello, love. Hello, love. Well, hello to you on a Saturday night. Welcome to this first portion of our show brought to you by Powder Milk Biscuits in the big blue box with a picture of the biscuit on the cover. We have a good show for you tonight, including a lot of good songs, including some songs that didn't exist until a day or two ago, including this one that Mr. Greg Brown wrote slowly just the other day.
Very slow.
In about 10 minutes. It's a food song for those of you who are just about to eat. It's called Slow Food.
People want their fast food, 2 minutes and they grouch. But give me ham baked all day long and help me to the couch. Help me to the sofa, turn some lazy music on. I lie and think about that ham long after it is gone. I want some slow food. Gravy on mashed potatoes. I want some slow food to slowly infiltrate us. I don't want that McDonald's. I want a cook and not a clown. Bring me some slow soup or stew and I'll slowly eat it down. I don't want no food with funny names, no neon on a sign. A man can't live on packaging and conceptual design. I want some slow food. Slow meats and sauce and pasta. I want some slow food. I don't need it no faster. Let's start a cooking in the morning. Let it simmer, let it rise. We get homemade fried fresh bread and soup and chicken pies. Let the juices run together and the spices and the greases. And improve by slow osmosis and absorption and synthesis. Just give me that slow food. Oh yeah, I want some slow food. Let someone else go to Burger King and the Colonel's carry out. I want my food to know itself before it knows my mouth. I don't want to grab a bite to eat. Quick service I don't need. Crockpots are for fast French fries. Crockpots are 4 feet. Give me that slow food.
I'll bring it to me. I want some slow food. Oh yeah, give me that slow food. Mm-mm-mm, bring me that slow food. Oh, I need some slow food.
Mr. Greg Brown, that was Tommy Lieberman down there with his slow guitar. Mr. Red Maddock on the drums. Mr. Bill Evans himself on the bass and himself at the piano. Mr. Charlie DeVore on the cornet going to come out and join this classy quintet here to do us a tune for Powder Milk Biscuits. Mister?
Why you haven't got someone to love. If you haven't got a sweetie, as the reason why you haven't got someone to love. Gentlemen from Maine to California, give me your attention while I warn you. You gotta be a football hero to get along with the beautiful girl. You gotta be a touchdown getter, you bet, if you wanna get a baby to pet. The fact that you are rich or handsome won't get you anything in curve. You gotta be a football hero to get along with the beautiful. Cagel, Grange, and Booth, Friedman, Newman, and Corradio, they're brutes. Kosky, Ooster, Bonn, and Kurth are the rulers of the earth, 'cause the ladies love them so. If the girls are what you wanna get, man, hurry and become a triple threat, man. You gotta be a football hero to get along with the beautiful girl. In spite of all $1 million can do, a tackle or two will mean more to you. If you can make the winning touchdown, you'll never have to buy them pearls. You gotta be a football hero to get along with the beautiful girl.
Is that right? Powder Milk Biscuits brings you this portion of our show. Let's sell a few biscuits here. Powder Milk Biscuits made from the whole wheat that give shy persons the strength to get up and do what needs to be done. Now, when I was young and most shy, what I thought needed to be done was to overcome shyness by becoming an amazing and fabulous person. And after I gave up on that, I still dreamed of having some amazing, fabulous talent, a secret talent, and dreamed of that wonderful time when I'd be able to spring it on people when they least expected it, so that they'd be amazed and they would say, "Where did you ever learn how to do that?" And I'd say, "Oh, it's just something I picked up." I suppose maybe you've had fantasies like that yourself. Fantasy of coming up to bat in the bottom of the ninth with the bases loaded and your team down by a run, and the captain who picked you last of all the